I was asked to be on this panel and saw the title, Winning Hearts and Minds, and saw the context of the theme of the entire meetings this weekend, not knowing what the other panelists would address, I guess that they would, the approach would be, how do we win the hearts and minds of the people in the Islamic world, the people who are opposed to the ideas of freedom that we understand would be good for them. And I thought that I would take a more internal look and talk about what is the state of those very ideas in our own country, partly because that's what I'm most experienced with. I work for an organization, have worked for a number of years for an organization that works with college students. And so I'm aware of what the youth who will be tomorrow's leaders are thinking or not thinking, as the case may be. So, Bill, you just referred to we need people who think in order to have a battle of ideas indeed. And our previous panelist referred to the John Quincy Adams quote about winning by example. And I want to argue that even if winning by example is not sufficient, it is certainly necessary. But in this country, in our own country, we have not been able to preserve a commitment to our founding fathers' ideas of individual liberty, private property and free enterprise, and a government limited to protecting those rights and liberties. We have lost that. I can tell you, because I work with, and I know there are a lot of students in this audience, and you can probably confirm it about most of your peers in our universities and colleges. We live in the most prosperous time and place in the history of mankind. And our children and grandchildren are largely clueless about where this prosperity comes from, about the sources of it, and about what freedom has to do with it. And I'm not just talking about clueless about economics. Most of them know nothing about economics. But they're clueless about the relationship between principles and this remarkable prosperity that we enjoy in the West, and about the intellectual tradition that has led to it. Some of the cluelessness is about basic facts. It is amazing to me that Americans, who are very privileged, and by the way, resent it enormously if you point out how privileged they are, because they preserve that term privilege for, if you're a feminist, for men, or if you're a minority, for whites. And if you point out to a middle-class American how privileged they are, they resent that deeply. They don't understand it. One of the our seminars for college students that I was directing 7 or 8 years ago, and it was one of our seminars for students who are not already aware of the ideas that we are trying to teach. After the first economics lecture, the hands go up right away. And the questions from the audience are, do you mean to say that people in Southeast Asian countries who are working for $2 a day for Nike are better off than that we should be glad that they're getting those jobs for $2 a day? And they were just outraged about this. And there was a Mongolian exchange student. She's from Mongolia but had been studying in the United States for several years, who was at the seminar. And I saw her hand go up and wondered what she was going to say. I can't remember the list of things, but it was a great economics lesson in the purchasing power of money, right? But then she ends this, and the outraged questioners had used the word sweatshops, and you're aware that the issue of sweatshops is a big one on college campuses. There are sit-ins in presidents' offices to stop the making of the sweatshirts and caps in sweatshops in third world countries and so on. So after she's said what $2 will purchase in my country, she says, In my country, Mongolia, we have no sweatshops. Please send us your sweatshops. And that kind of understanding of what the rest of the world is like is largely absent from kids in America and, I believe, in Western European countries that enjoy prosperity similar to ours. So that's disturbing, but I think even more disturbing is that these students are mostly suspicious of the very legitimacy of the society we live in and of that prosperity and of the principles that underlie it. They're suspicious of private property. They're suspicious of free enterprise. They are, in some fundamental sense, suspicious of individual rights versus some notions of collectivism at a very basic level. Why is this so? How did we get here? It's not going to be a surprise to you when I say it's because their professors, the media, the popular culture that has been referred to, is largely telling them that free enterprise is unjust, that we are all victims of our circumstances, and the worse off you are, the more you are a victim, that we are collectively responsible for one another, that the idea of self-government that our founders took as a very basic principle of morality and of politics doesn't work, that people cannot be held responsible for their own actions, that government is the solution to most of our problems. If a problem comes up, government is the solution and not individuals and voluntary associations. But the larger question is, how did we get here? How did we arrive at a place where intellectual arenas in our culture are dominated by these ideas? There are various answers to that question. I'm always returned to an essay written by F.A. Hayek, The Intellectuals and Socialism. Hayek, of course, also wrote earlier than that The Road to Serfdom, went on to write other works like The Constitution of Liberty, and his final work, The Fatal Conceit. But in The Intellectuals and Socialism, an essay that he wrote in 1948 or 49, John, was published originally in the Chicago Law Review. Imagine the Chicago Law Review today publishing an essay like that. In that essay, Hayek worried that socialists, we end up here because socialists are attracted to the intellectual arenas, and that the best minds on our side, if you will, if I can speak of sides in this war, the best minds on our side instead go into building enterprises, becoming doctors and lawyers, and making the world work, if you will. And indeed, if you are aware of some of the recent studies, one of my colleagues at George Mason University, Dan Klein, has published a study recently in which he looked at the political affiliation of academics at both elite institutions and across a variety of institutions, and in both cases found a huge imbalance of academics, professors who self-identify as Democrat versus Republican. Depending on the discipline, it's not so bad, 3-1 Democrats to Republicans in economics, but 18-20-1 in anthropology, sociology, and so on, and across that range in other disciplines. And there have been similar studies. You have probably seen numbers like that for journalists as well, which are very similar. I've not seen such surveys of people in Hollywood, in television and film, but I'm sure it's very, very similar. None of us would be shocked. But is this necessarily so? I've painted a grim picture of how what college students think, and they will be tomorrow's professors, tomorrow's journalists, tomorrow's screenwriters, and shown the numbers for the current generation in those intellectual arenas, but is this necessarily the case? I want to argue that it is not, and that we can actually change hearts and minds, and that Hayek's essay, in a way, lays out a roadmap. At least that's the roadmap that we have taken at the Institute for Humane Studies. And that it is indeed important that we be cultivating people going into these intellectual areas, that we be showing those possibilities to young people and encouraging that pursuit. And that, in fact, is what our organization started doing when it was founded by a former economics professor in 1961. In the first part of its history, it was basically collecting the remnant, keeping the remnant alive. And as of about 1980, our IHS started a highly leveraged strategy of reaching today's college students, educating them, and identifying those who embrace the ideas of individual liberty, free enterprise, and limited government, and have the talent and desire to go into the academic world. And later, we started a set of programs that also helped them into journalism, public policy, and our latest area of activity is helping people into popular culture, film and fiction. We've had some success with that. Now, when I was asked to be on this panel, Bill Campbell cautioned that he did not want me to spend a lot of time talking about all the great things that IHS does. And I'm taking that, that admonition seriously. So I won't belabor that I think we're seeing some success there. Some of you may have seen an article in, and I'm now moving on from IHS, have seen an article in The Economist recently saying that in America in particular, public intellectuals are thriving, and attributing some of this to the burgeoning number of think tanks that we have in this country, but also to the open political debate. And I think that's very, very interesting. Of course, we have a long way to go. I said that we're seeing some success in that with that, but we do have a long way to go in this country. However, my experience with young people is that there is, of those who are interested in ideas, and our guess is we've seen data that indicates about 15% of the, and by the way, how many students are there in colleges and universities in the United States? Any guesses? Right now. 4 million? Higher, lower?
Higher.
It's 12 million, 11.8, something like that. 12 million. There's an organization at a unit at UCLA that does a freshman survey every year. And based on a number of questions they ask about, you know, do you ever have a conversation with your professor outside of class? And they ask a number of questions about activities they're involved in and so on. Our best guess is that about 15% of college and university students are actually interested in ideas, as opposed to there to, you know, do what they have to do to get a job, or the peer pressure to go, or whatever. I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought. So, what I wanted to say is that many of those students have never been exposed to the ideas that we take seriously. And it's not, and I want to say, there's a hunger for ideas, not necessarily for those ideas, but there's actually a hunger to be challenged to think hard. And often their university educations are not giving them that. And that's why I think there's actually hope for winning hearts and minds. And my thesis here is that we have to win hearts and minds. We have to re-win this intellectual battle in our very own country if we are going to be successful in bringing freedom anywhere else, which is the ambition that has been stated for some of our current activities around the world. And I suggest that if we do want to change ideas in these other countries, it will, like it will be in this country, from where we are now, a long march through the institutions. It will require time, it will require patience, and it will require not only that we win minds, but that we do take seriously the other word that is in our title for this panel this afternoon, the hearts, hearts and minds. I think many times the people who are devoted to the ideas that we are devoted to have not taken seriously the importance of not only the intellectual part, but the emotional and spiritual part of what the battle of ideas. We, in our own work, we have learned by trying and failing. About 8 years ago, we started educational programs that reach out seriously to students who have not already stumbled on these ideas. And Lord knows it's hard enough to stumble on these ideas in our culture, because they're not there in our universities, not there in the media, not there in our popular culture. So we started reaching out to students who are, as we say, clueless or skeptical. And our first efforts at this, we failed because we did not know how to reach people. And so we've learned some things. Things like you have to find some common ground to start from, some value that you share in common with your particular audience. On the issue of globalization, for example, where students were in the streets and throwing bricks through the windows and saying that capitalism kills. I actually saw that on the helmet of an anti-globalization protester. Capitalism kills. No, capitalism, free enterprise, has actually lifted millions and millions of people out of poverty. But what we found is that if we identify with those students' interest in alleviating poverty, then we can start to make progress. Then we can start to lay ideas on them. But first, find common ground. We have to have a positive vision. And again, I think that we have often been negative. We have been contrarians about the status quo, and for good reason. But we have to have positive vision that speaks to people's values, that speaks to human longings for meaning and for connection. And we often, and this is hard for people who have come to these ideas by argument, we have to tap into people's emotions with stories that connect, stories about human beings that connect. And these are some of the lessons that we have learned as we have engaged in outreach to skeptical audiences. So in conclusion, I would urge our side to take seriously the importance of effective communication, of trying new means, and if we do, we can have some success. There has been no greater joy in my life than seeing the light bulb come on for a student who starts out the week at one of our seminars being totally against us, objecting to everything, and at some point it starts to connect, the light bulb comes on, and that is a wonderful experience. So it is possible. We can change hearts and minds, and we need to do it internally if we're going to do it externally. Thank you.